university, her mother says. Already that dream is losing substance. It is something her father had dreamed for her, that one day she too would be a poet. Finally, she is the grown-up she'd longed to be, and she has no choices now. Not a peasant girl like her. She understands this at last. Her future has been changed by this arrest. Fixed. There will be no schooling for her, no handsome boys carrying her schoolbooks or kissing her under street lamps. No Sasha. I do not want to smell like bread all day. She feels her mother's nod. They are connected like that now, the three of them. When one moves, they all feel it. Ripples in a pond. I will go to the Royal Library tomorrow, Vera says. She is 16. How can she possibly understand the mistake she has just made? Who could have known that people she loved would die because of it? 12. What do you mean, people will die? What's her mistake? Nina said when her mother fell silent. We've never heard that part of the story before. Yes, you have. It scared Meredith, so I sometimes skipped it. Nina got up and went to the bed, turning on the lamp. In the soft light, her mother looked like a ghost, unmoving, her eyes closed. I am tired. You will leave me now. Nina wanted to argue. She could sit in the dark and listen to her mother's voice for hours. About that, her father had been right. The fairy tale connected them somehow. And her mother might be feeling it, too. Nina was certain Mom was elaborating, going deeper into the story than ever before. Did she, like Nina, want to keep it going? Had Dad asked that of her? Can I bring you anything before I go? Nina asked. My knitting. Nina looked around, saw the bulging bag stuffed alongside the rocking chair. Retrieving it, she went back to the bed. In no time, Mom's hands were moving over the coil of blue-green mohair yarn. Nina left the room, hearing the click-click-click of the needles as she closed the door. She stopped by the bathroom and pushed the door open. The room was empty. Alone, she went downstairs and put a log on the dwindling fire. She poured herself a glass of wine and sat down on the hearth. Wow, she said. Wow. It was a hell of a story, worth listening to, if for no other reason than to hear a mother speak with such passion and power. The woman who told that story was someone else entirely, not the cold, distant Anya Whitson of Nina's youth. Was that the secret her father wanted her to glimpse? That somewhere, buried beneath the silent exterior, lay a different woman? Was that her father's gift? A glimpse, finally, at the woman with whom he had fallen in love? Or was there more to it? The story was so much richer and more detailed than she remembered. Or maybe she hadn't really listened before. The story had always been something she'd taken for granted. Like a picture you saw so often, you never wondered who it was that had taken it, or who that was standing in the background. But once you'd noticed the oddity, it threw everything else into question. Well, she'd noticed it now, and she wanted answers. Meredith hadn't intended to listen to her mother's fairy tale, but as she sat in the ridiculously overstocked bathroom, going through drawers full of over-the-counter and prescription medications dating back to 1980, she heard the voice. That was how she'd always thought of it, even as a girl. Without making a conscious decision, she finished packing the box, marked it bathroom, and dragged it into the hallway. There she heard the words from her childhood float through the open door. Maybe she is thinking of boys. Of a boy. Meredith felt a shiver. She recognized her own longing. It was familiar to her, that feeling of wanting something from her mother. She had known it all of her life. She knew she should leave the bathroom and walk down the hallway and out of the house, but she couldn't do it. The lure of Mom's voice, as sweet and honeyed as any fairy tale witch's, snared her as it always had. And before she really thought about it, she found herself crossing the hallway, standing at the partially open door, listening. It wasn't until she heard Nina's sharp voice say, "What do you mean, people will die?" that the spell broke. Meredith backed away from the door quickly. She definitely did not want to be caught eavesdropping. Nina would take it as interest and pounce. Hurrying down the stairs, she was home in no time. The dogs greeted her with dizzying enthusiasm. She was so relieved to have been missed that when she let them inside, she dropped to her knees on the mudroom floor and hugged them both, letting their nuzzling and face-licking substitute for the sound of her husband's voice. "Good puppies," she murmured, scratching the soft hair behind their ears. Getting tiredly to her feet, she went to the closet beside the washer and dryer and got the giant bag of dog food, Jeff's job, and poured some into their silver bowls. After a quick check that they had plenty of fresh water, she went into the kitchen. The room was empty, quiet, with no lingering scents. She stood there in the darkness, paralyzed by the thought of the night to come. No wonder she'd stayed for the story. Anything was better than facing her empty bed. She called each of her daughters, left "I love you" messages, and then made herself a cup of tea. Grabbing a heavy blanket, she went outside to sit on the porch. At least the quiet out here felt natural. She could lose herself in the endless starlit sky, in the smell of rich black earth, in the sweet scent of new growth. In this month that was a pause between spring and summer, the first tiny apples were out on the trees. In no time, the orchards would be full of fruit and workmen and pickers. It was her dad's favorite time of year, this moment when everything was possible and he could still hope for the best crop ever. She had tried to love Belianocchi as her father had. She loved him, so she tried to love what he had loved. And what she'd ended up with was a facsimile of his life, lacking the passion he had brought to it. She closed her eyes and leaned back. The wicker swing back bit into her neck, but she didn't care. The rusty old chains on either side squeaked as she pushed off with her feet. "You're like her." That was what Jeff had said. Wrapping the blanket more tightly around her, she finished her tea and went upstairs, letting the dogs come up the stairs behind her. In her room, she took a sleeping pill and crawled into bed, pulling the covers up past her chin. Curling into a fetal position, she tried to focus on the chuffing sound of the dog's breathing. Finally, somewhere past midnight, she fell into a troubled, fitful sleep until her alarm went off at 5:47. Batting the off button, she tried to go back to sleep, but it was a wasted effort. So she got up, dressed in her running clothes, and ran for 6 miles. When she got home, she was exhausted enough to climb back into bed, but she didn't dare take that route. Work was the key, keeping busy. She thought about going into work, although on the beautiful sunny Sunday, someone was liable to see her car, and if Daisy found out that Meredith had come in on a Sunday, the Inquisition would begin. She decided to go to Belianocchi and make sure Nina was taking good care of Mom. There was still plenty of packing to be done. An hour later, dressed in an old pair of jeans and a navy blue sweatshirt, she showed up at Mom's house, calling out, "Hello!" as she came into the kitchen. Nina was at the kitchen table, wearing the same clothes she'd been in yesterday, with her short black hair spiked out in all directions. There were several books open on the table and pieces of paper lay scattered about, with Nina's bold scrawl covering most of the sheets. You look like the Unabomber, Meredith said. Good morning to you, too. Have you slept at all? Some. What's wrong? I know you don't care, but it's the fairy tale. I can't get it out of my head. Nina looked up. She mentioned the Fontanka Bridge last night. It was always the Enchanted Bridge before, wasn't it? Does that seem odd to you? The fairy tale, Meredith said. I should have known. Listen to this. The Fontanka is a branch of the River Neva, which flows through the city of Leningrad. Meredith poured herself a cup of coffee. She's Russian. The story takes place in Russia. Stop the presses. You should have been there, Mayor. It was amazing. Last night was all new. No, it wasn't, she thought. Maybe you were just too young to remember. I am not getting sucked into all this. How can you not be interested? We've never heard the end of it. Meredith turned around slowly, looking at her sister. I'm tired, Neens. I don't know if you know how that feels, really. You're always so in love with everything you do. But I've spent most of my life on this piece of property, and I've tried to get to know Mom. She won't let it happen. That's the answer. The end. She'll lure you in, make you think there's something more. You'll see sadness in her eyes sometimes, or a softening in her mouth, and you'll seize on it and believe in it because you want to so much, but it's all a lie. She just doesn't love us. And frankly, I've got problems of my own right now, so I'll have to say a polite no, thank you, on your fairy tale quest. What problems? Meredith looked down at her coffee. She'd forgotten for a split second that it was Nina to whom she was speaking. Nina, with her journalist's knack for getting to the heart of a thing instantly, and her fearlessness in asking questions. Nothing. It was just an expression. You're lying. Meredith gave a tired smile and went to the table, sitting down across from her sister. I don't want to fight with you, Neens. So talk to me. You'd be the last person who would understand, and I'm not being a bitch. It's just the truth. Why do you say that? Danny Flynn. You've been with him for more than 4 years, but none of us ever even heard of him. I know about the places you've been and the photographs you've taken, even the beaches you like, but I don't know anything about the man you love. Who said I loved him? Exactly. I don't know if you've ever been in love. It's stories that matter to you. Like this thing with Mom. Of course you're hooked. She made a sweeping gesture with her hand, indicating the books spread out on the table. Just don't expect all of this to mean anything, because it doesn't. She won't let it. And please, please quit trying to make me care. I can't. Not like that. About her. Not again. Okay? Nina stared at her. The pity in her eyes was almost unbearable. Okay. Meredith nodded and got to her feet. Good. Now I'm going to run to the grocery store, and then I'll come back and do some more packing. You need to keep busy, Nina said. Meredith ignored the knowing tone in her sister's voice. It doesn't look like I'm the only one. I'll see you in a few hours. Make sure Mom eats a good meal. Smiling tightly, she headed for her car. Nina spent the rest of the day alternately taking pictures of the orchard and surfing the internet. Unfortunately, the dial-up connection at Belyanochi was impossibly slow, so it took forever to look things up. Not that there was much to find. What she'd learned was that Russia had a rich fairy tale tradition that was different in many ways from the Grimm's type of stories that were more familiar to Americans. There were literally dozens of peasant girl and prince stories, and often they ended unhappily to teach a lesson. None of it illuminated the story Nina was being told. Finally, as night fell outside, Meredith opened the study door and said, "Dinner's ready." Nina winced. She'd meant to quit earlier and help with dinner, but as usual, Once she started researching something, time fell away from her. "Thanks," she said, and closed down the computer. Then she went into the kitchen, where she found Mom seated at the table. There were three place settings. Nina looked at her sister. "You're staying for dinner again? Should we call Jeff down and invite him?" "He's working late," Meredith said, taking a casserole out of the oven. "Again? You know news. The stories happen at all hours." Nina got the decanter of vodka and three shot glasses and brought them to the table. She sat down next to Mom, poured. Her hands in puffy, insulated gloves, Meredith carried the hot casserole dish to the table and set it down on a pair of trivets. "Chanaki," Nina said, leaning close, breathing in the savory aroma of the lamb and vegetable casserole. It had come out of Mom's freezer, so it would taste exquisite, even reheated. The vegetables would be perfectly tender, their flavors merged into a silken tangle of tomatoes, sweet peppers, green beans, and Walla Walla sweet onions, all of it swimming in a rich garlic and lemon-tinged lamb broth with big chunks of succulent meat. It was one of Nina's favorites. "Great choice, Meredith." Meredith pulled up a chair and sat down between them. Nina handed her a straight shot of vodka. "Again?" Meredith said, frowning. "Wasn't last night enough? It's a new tradition." "It smells like pine needles," Meredith said, wrinkling her nose as she smelled it.
"The taste is quite different," Mom said.
Nina laughed at that and raised her shot glass. They dutifully clinked the glasses together and drank. Then Nina reached for the serving spoon.
"I'll dish up. Meredith, why don't you start?"
"The three things again?"
"You can do as many as you want. We'll follow your lead."
Mom said nothing, just shook her head.
"Fine," Meredith said, as Nina ladled the casserole into her sister's white china bowl. "My favorite time of day is dawn. I love sitting on my porch in the summer, and Jeff thinks I run too much."
While Nina was figuring out her response to that, Mom surprised her by saying,
"My favorite time of day is night. Bella noche. I love cooking, and your father thinks I should learn to play the piano."
Nina heard the word thinks, and it made her look up. For a moment, they all looked at each other. Mom was the first to glance away.
"He thought this. Do not rush me to the doctors, Meredith," she said. "I know he is not here."
Meredith nodded, but said nothing. Nina filled in the awkward silence.
"My favorite time of day is sunset, preferably in Botswana, in the dry season. I love answers. And I think there's a reason Mom hardly ever looks at us."
"It is meaning you want," Mom said. "You will be disappointed. Now eat. I hate this dish when it is cold."
Nina recognized her mother's tone. It meant that the frivolity of their little tradition had come to an end. The rest of the meal proceeded in silence. The only sounds were spoons scraping on fine china and wine glasses being set down on the wooden table. And when dinner was over, Meredith rose to her feet and went to the sink. Mom walked gracefully away.
"I'm going to hear more of the story tonight," Nina said to Meredith, who was drying the silverware.
Her sister didn't turn around. Neither did she answer.
"I need to go through Dad's study," Meredith said. "I need some of his files at the office."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm sure. I've been putting it off."
There were places in every home that belonged to a single individual. No matter how many family members might use a space or come and go through it, there was one in the group to whom it truly belonged. In Meredith's home, the porch was hers. Jeff and the girls used it on occasion, but rarely. Summertime parties and such. Meredith loved that porch, and sat in the wicker rocker throughout the year.
In Bella Noche, almost every room belonged to her mom. Her damaged eyesight was reflected in all the decorations and furniture, from the kitchen with its pale walls and white tile counters to its antique wooden table and chairs. Where there was color in this house, it came in splashes. The nesting dolls in the windowsill, the gilded icons in the holy corner, the painting of the troika. Of all the rooms in Bella Noche, only one could truly be called her father's. And it was this room, his study. Meredith stood in the doorway. She didn't have to close her eyes to imagine him at his desk, laughing, talking to the two little girls at play on the floor at his feet. The echo of his voice was strong in here. She could almost smell the sweet tang of his pipe smoke. "Don't tell your mom now. You know she hates it when I smoke." She went to the center of the room and knelt on the thick forest green carpet. A pair of black watch plaid club chairs stood cocked toward each other, facing the giant mahogany desk that dominated the room. The walls were a rich cobalt blue with black trim, and everywhere she looked was a family photograph framed in forest green leather. She sat back on her heels, overcome for a moment at the idea of what she was to do in here. Only his clothes would be more difficult to go through. But it had to be done, and she was the one to do it. She and Mom would both need documents from this room in the coming months and years. Insurance information, bill records, tax records, and banking information, just to name a few. So Meredith took a deep breath and opened his file drawer. For the next hour, as night fell outside, she carefully picked through the paper trail of her parents' lives, sorting everything into three piles: keep, maybe, and burn. She was grateful for the concentration it took to do the sorting. Only rarely did she find her mind wandering into the swamp of her own broken marriage. Like now, as she stared down at a picture that had somehow fallen into the property tax file. In the photograph, Dad, Nina, Jeff, Jillian, and Maddie were playing catch in the front yard. The girls were small, barely taller than the mailbox, and dressed in matching pink snowsuits. Christmas lights and evergreen boughs decorated the fences, and everyone was laughing. But where was she? She'd probably been in the dining room, setting the table with Martha Stewart-level obsessiveness, or wrapping gifts or rearranging the decorations. She hadn't been where it mattered, making memories with her husband and children. Maybe she'd thought time was more elastic, or love more forgiving. She set the picture on the file and opened another drawer. As she reached inside, she heard footsteps, the thump of the front door, and the sound of Nina's voice in the living room. Of course, night had fallen and driven Nina back into the house, where her sister would undoubtedly exchange one obsession, her camera, for another, the fairy tale. Meredith grabbed a file and pulled it out, seeing that the label had been partially ripped. The part she could make out read, "Beppa Net Podbaha." She was pretty sure that the letters were Russian. Inside, she found a single letter, postmarked 20 years ago from Anchorage, Alaska, and addressed to Mrs. Evan Whitson. "Dear Mrs. Whitson, thank you for your recent reply to my query. While I am certain that you can provide invaluable insight into my Leningrad study, I certainly understand your decision. If, however, you ever change your mind, I would welcome your participation. Sincerely, Vasily Adamovich, Professor of Russian Studies, University of Alaska." Behind her, and through the open door, she heard Nina say something to Mom. Then there was a long, drawn-out silence. Finally, her mother said something, and Nina answered, and her mother began to speak again. The fairy tale. There was no mistaking the sound of it. Meredith hesitated, telling herself to stay where she was, that none of this mattered to her, that it couldn't matter, that Mom wouldn't let it. But when she heard Vera, she folded the strange letter, put it back in its envelope, and dropped it onto the keep pile. Then she got to her feet. 13. Nina put her camera on the coffee table and walked over to her mother, who sat in Dad's favorite chair, knitting. Even on this warm May evening, a chill hung in the living room, so Nina built a fire. "Are you ready?" she asked her mother. Mom looked up. Her face was pale, her cheeks a little drawn, but her eyes were as bright and clear as ever. "Where did we leave off? Come on, Mom. You remember." Mom stared at her for a long time and then said, "The lights." Nina turned off all the lights in the living room and entryway. The fire gave the darkness a blazing heart, and she sat on the floor in front of the sofa. For a moment, the house was almost preternaturally silent, as if it, too, were waiting. Then the fire crackled, and somewhere a floorboard creaked. The house settled in for the story. Her mother began slowly. "In the year following her father's imprisonment in the Red Tower, Vera becomes somebody. And in the Snow Kingdom, in these dark times, that is a dangerous thing to be. She is no longer just an ordinary peasant girl, the daughter of a poor country tutor. She is the eldest daughter of a banned poet, a relative of an enemy of the realm. She must be careful. Always. The first weeks without Papa are strange. Their neighbors will no longer make eye contact with Vera. When she comes up the stairs at night, doors clap shut in a sound like falling cards. The black carriages are everywhere these days, as are the whispered stories of arrest, of people being turned to smoke and lost forever. By the time she is 17, Vera can recognize other families of criminals. They move like victims, with their shoulders hunched and their eyes cast downward, trying to make themselves smaller, unremarkable, unnoticeable. This is how Vera moves now. No more does she spend time in front of a mirror trying to be pretty for boys. She just tries to get by. She wakens early every morning and dresses in a black shapeless dress. Clothes do not matter to her anymore. Neither does it matter that her shoes are ugly and her socks do not match. Like this, she makes kasha in the mornings for her sister, who has become a pale shadow of Vera, and for her mother, who rarely speaks anymore. The sound of her crying can be heard most nights. For months, Vera tried to comfort her mother, but it was a wasted effort. Her mother cannot be comforted. None of them can. So they go on, doing what they must to survive. Vera works long days at the castle library. In rooms scented by dust, leather, and stone, she turns in the last of her father's dreams for her, that she will become a writer. She hands it in like an overdue book and takes joy in the words of others. Whenever she has time, she disappears into a corner and pores through stories and poems. But she cannot do this often or for long. Vera can never forget that she is being watched, always. Lately, even children are being arrested. In this way are parents made to confess. Vera is terrified that one day the black carriages with the three trolls will arrive at her building again, and that they will have come for her. Or worse, for Olga or Mama. It is only when she is truly alone, in her bed at night, with Olga snoring gently beside her, that she allows herself to even remember the girl she'd once imagined herself to be. It is then, in the quiet darkness, With cold winter air sweeping through the thin glass of her closed window, that she thinks of Sasha and how his kiss made her cry. She tries to forget about him, but even as months pass with no word from him, she cannot forget. Vera, her sister whispers in the dark. I'm awake, she answers. Olga immediately snuggles closer to her. I'm cold. Vera puts her arms around her younger sister and holds her close. She knows she should say something comforting. As the older sister, it is her job to lift Olga's spirits, and it is an obligation she takes seriously, but she is so tired. She hasn't enough of herself left to share. Finally, Vera gets out of bed and dresses quickly. Hiding her long hair beneath a kerchief, she goes into the cold kitchen, where a pot of water-thinned kasha sits on the stove. Mama is gone already, earlier than usual, even. She leaves every morning well before dawn for her job at the Royal Food Warehouse. When she finally comes home at night, she is too tired to do more than kiss her girls and go to bed. Vera reheats the kasha for her sister, sweetening it with a big dollop of honey, and takes it to her. Sitting together on the bed, they eat breakfast in silence. Today again, Olga finally says, scraping the bowl for the last speck of food. Today, Vera confirms. It is the same thing she has said to her sister every Friday since their papa was taken away. She has no words to add to it. Olga knows this. Hope is a fragile thing, easily broken if handled too much. So, saying no more, they dress for work and leave the building together. Outside, winter is gnashing its teeth. Vera lifts her collar upward and walks briskly forward, her body angled into the wind. Snowflakes scald her cheeks. On the frozen river, she sees scores of fishermen hunched around holes in the ice. At the corner, she and Olga go their separate ways. Moments later, Vera hears the distant roar of a dragon and sees a black carriage turning onto this street, its color vivid amid the falling snow and the white stone of their walled kingdom. She dives into the shadowy snowbank beneath a crystal tree. Someone is being arrested. Someone's family is being ruined, and all Vera can think is, thank God it is not my family this time. She waits until the carriage is gone and gets back to her feet. In the slicing snow, she takes the trolley across town to a place that has become as familiar to her as her own arm. At the entrance to the Great Hall of Justice, she pauses just long enough to square her shoulders. She opens the huge stone door and goes inside. The first thing she sees is a queue of woolen-clad women wearing felt boots and clapping their mittened hands together to keep warm. They move forward, always forward, people in line, waiting for their turn. The next 2 hours pass in a gray blur, until at last Vera is at the front of the line. She gathers her courage and straightens as she walks up to the gleaming marble desk where a goblin sits in a tall chair, his face as pale and shapeless as melting wax, his golden eyes opening and closing like those of a serpent. Name, he says. She answers in as even a voice as she can. Your husband, he says, his voice a hiss in the quiet. Father, give me your papers. She slides her papers across the cold desk, watching his slim, hairy hand close over them. It takes courage to stand there while he studies her paperwork. What if he has her name on a list? Or if they've been waiting for her? It is dangerous to keep coming here, or so her mother tells her. But Vera cannot stop. Coming here is the only hope she has now. He hands her papers back to her. The case is being studied, he says, and then yells, Next! She stumbles away from the window quickly, hearing an old woman come up beside her and ask about her husband. It is good news. Her father is alive. He has not been sentenced and sent to the barons. Or worse. Soon, the Black Knight will realize his error. He will learn that her father is no traitor. She flips her collar up and goes back out into the cold. If she hurries, she can be to work by noon. Friday after Friday, Vera goes to see the goblin. Each time the answer is the same. The case is being studied. Next. And then her mother tells her they must move. There is nothing to be done about it, Vera, her mother says, sitting slumped in a chair at the kitchen table. The past year has taken a toll on her, left its mark in wrinkles. She smokes a cheap cigarette and seems hardly to care that ashes flutter to the wood floor. My wages at the storehouse have been cut. We cannot pay the bills here anymore. Vera would like to argue with her mother as she used to, but there is not enough money for firewood at night, and they are cold. Where will we go? Vera asks. Beside her, she hears Olga whine. My mother offered. Vera is actually surprised by this. Even Olga looks up. We don't even know her, Vera says. Her mother takes another long drag on the cigarette and exhales the thin blue smoke. My parents did not approve of your father. Now that he is gone... He's not gone, Vera says, deciding right then that she will never like this grandmother, let alone love her. Though her mother says nothing, the look in her dark eyes is easy to read. He is gone. Olga touches Vera, whether for support or in comfort, Vera is unsure. When do we move? Tonight, before the landlord comes to collect the rent. Once, Vera would have talked back or argued. Now she sighs quietly and goes into her room. There is little enough to pack up. A few clothes, some blankets, a hairbrush, and her old felt boots, which she has almost outgrown. In no time, they are outside, dressed in layers that represent almost all of their clothing. They trudge through the snow toward their new home. At last they arrive. The building is small, and it looks unkempt. A stone facade on the stoop is crumbling away. Cheap fabric curtains hang at odd angles in several of the windows. Up the stairs they go, to the last apartment on the second floor. The woman who answers is heavy and sad-looking, wearing a floral housecoat that has seen better days. Her gray hair is covered by a pale green kerchief. She is smoking a cigarette, and her fingers are discolored where it rests between them. Zoya, the woman says, and these are my grandchildren, Veronica and Olga. Which is which? I am Vera, she says, standing tall beneath her new grandmother's scrutiny. The woman nods. There will be no problem with you, yes? We do not need the trouble you have had. There will be no trouble, Mama says quietly, and they are shown inside. Vera stops dead. Olga bumps into her and giggles, but her laughter stops abruptly. The apartment is a single room with a small wood-burning stove and a sink, a wooden table with four mismatched chairs, and a narrow bed pushed against the wall. A curtainless window stares out at the brick wall across the alley. In the corner, a half-open door reveals an empty closet. There is no bathroom. It must be a communal one for the building. How can they all live here, crammed together like rats in a shoebox? Come, her grandmother says, grinding out the butt of her cigarette in a saucer overflowing with ashes. I will show you where to put your things. Hours later,
On this first night in their new home, in the room that smells of boiled cabbage and too many people, Vera makes a bed of blankets on the floor and snuggles close to her sister. A man from work will bring our furniture over tomorrow, Mama says tiredly. Olga begins to cry. They all know that furniture will not matter much. Vera takes hold of her sister's hand. Outside, a cart crashes into something. A man yells out a curse, and Vera can't help thinking that they are the sounds of a dying dream. After that, Vera is angry all of the time. And although she tries to hide her displeasure with life, she knows she fails to do so. She is sharp-tempered and quick to criticize. She and her mother and Olga sleep together in their narrow bed, crammed so close that they must turn in unison or not at all. She works from dawn until dark, and when she gets back to the apartment, it is more of the same. She cooks dinner with her mother and grandmother, then carries firewood to the stove for the night and washes the dishes. Working, working, working. Only on Fridays is it different. You should quit going there, her mother says as they leave the apartment. It is 5 in the morning, and dark as jet in the streets. As they pass a cafe, a group of drunken young noblemen stumble out, laughing and hugging one another, and Vera feels an ache in her chest at the sight of them. They are so young, so free, and yet they are older than she, who trudges along beside her mother and sister, going to work at dawn instead of drinking coffee and arguing politics and writing important words. Her mother reaches out and takes Vera's hand. I'm sorry, she says quietly. Rarely do they touch on the truth of their lives or the loss. Vera squeezes her mother's hand. She wants to say, I know, or, it's okay. But she is afraid she'll cry, so she just nods. Well, goodbye then, her mother finally says, turning toward her trolley stop. See you tonight. The three of them go their separate ways to work. Alone, Vera walks the last few blocks to the Great Hall of Justice. She enters the long queue and waits her turn. Name, says the goblin at the desk when it is her turn. At her answer, he takes her papers and reads them. Abruptly, he gets up from his chair and leaves. Down the hall, in a great glassed chamber, she can see him talking to other goblins, and then to a man in long black robes. Finally, the goblin returns, takes his seat, and pushes the papers back to her. There is no one of that name in our kingdom. You are mistaken. Next. But you do have him, my lord. I have been coming here for more than a year. Please check again. No one of that name is known here. But he's not here. The goblin says, sneering. Gone. Get it? Now move on. He cranes his head to look around her. Next. Vera wants to sink to her knees and cry out, but it is not good to draw attention to oneself, so she wipes the tears from her eyes and straightens her shoulders and heads for work. Her father is gone. There one moment, and disappeared the next. The truth is that he is dead, that they have killed him, whoever they are. The trolls in their shiny black carriages and the Black Knight for whom they work. Questions cannot be asked, though, not even the ordinary questions of a grieving family. They cannot beg to bury him or visit his gravesite or dress his body for burial. All of that would draw attention to them and to this execution that the Black Knight wants to deny. In the library, she goes about her work and says nothing about her father. On her walk home, no trolleys for her today, she wants this journey to last,
It seems as if winter is rising from the ground itself. Brittle black leaves fall from the trees and hang suspended in the chilly air. From a distance, there are so many of them it looks like a flock of crows flying too low. Beneath a leaden sky, buildings look drab and hunkered down. Even the mint-green castle looks forlorn in this weather. By the time she gets home, the snow is accumulating on the cobblestone street and on the bare tree limbs. At her door, she pauses just long enough to catch her breath. In that instant, she imagines the conversation she will have, and exhaustion presses down on her. Still, she straightens her spine and walks inside. The room is crowded with furniture from their old life. Her grandmother's bed is pushed up to the wall and stacked with quilts. Their own narrower bed abuts the closet. When they want to open the closet door, they must move the bed. A bureau that her mother has hand-painted and a pair of lamps line the wall beneath the window that won't open. The only beautiful piece of furniture in the apartment, a gorgeous mahogany writing desk that was her father's, is covered with jars of pickles and onions. She finds her mother at the stove. Olga is at the table peeling potatoes. Her mother takes one look at her and moves the pot off the stove, then wipes her hands on the apron tied about her waist. Although her dress is baggy and old, and her hair is unkempt after a day at the food storehouse, her eyes are keen, and the look in them is knowing. "It is Friday," she says at last. Olga rises from her chair. In a dress that is too tight, she looks like a flower sprouting from a seed shell. Vera can't help thinking that her sister is a child at 15, and yet she remembers it as the age when she met Sasha. She had thought she was full grown then, a woman standing on a bridge with the man she intended to love. "Did you learn something?" Olga asks. Vera can feel the color draining from her face. "Come, Olga," Mama says briskly. "Put on your coat and your valenki. We are going for a walk."
"But my boots are too small for me," Olga whines, "and it is snowing."
"No argument," her mother says, walking over to the big rounded wood and leather chest by their bed. "Your grandmother will be home soon from work." Vera stands back, saying nothing while her mother and sister dress for the cold. When everyone is ready, they go outside into the blurry white world. The hush of the falling flakes mutes everything around them. Even the whine and clatter of the trolley sounds distant. In this whispered world, they seem isolated, separate. They are even more alone as they enter the Grand Park. By the time they arrive, street lamps are lit throughout the square. There are no people out here on this cold early evening. Only the gilded row of noble houses in the distance. They come to the centerpiece of the park, the giant bronze statue of a winged horse. It rises up from the snow in defiance, dwarfing everyone who looks upon it. "These are dangerous times," Mama says when they are in front of the statue. "There are things, people, that cannot be spoken of in the closeness of an apartment or the confines even of a friendship. We will speak of it." She pauses, draws in a breath, and softens her voice. "Him? Now, and not again." "Yes." Olga stamps her foot in the snow.
"What is going on?"
Mama looks to Vera for the answer. "I went to the Great Hall today to ask about Papa," she says, feeling tears sting her eyes.
"He is gone." "What does that mean?" Olga says. "Gone? Do you think he escaped?"
It is Mama who has the strength to shake her head. "No. He has not escaped. She glances around again and moves closer, so that the three of them are touching each other, huddled together in the shadow of the statue. They have killed him. Olga makes a terrible sound, like she is choking, and Vera and Mama hug her tightly. When they draw back, all are crying. You knew, Vera says, not bothering to wipe her eyes, although her tears are freezing instantly, sticking her eyelashes together until she can hardly see. Mother nods. When they took him away? She nods again. You let me go every Friday, Vera says. If I had known, you had to learn in your way, her mother says. And I hoped. Of course. I do not know what to do now, Vera says. She feels disconnected from herself, from her own life. I have been waiting for you to ask me this, Mama says. You both have been waiting, hoping. Now you know. This is our life. Our Petya will not come back. This is who we are now.
What does that mean? Asks Olga.
Live, Mama says quietly. And Vera understands. It is time for her to quit marking time and start doing something with it. I do not know what to dream about, Vera says. It all seems so impossible. Dreams are for men like your father. They are the reason we mourn him now, in private and secretly, as if we are criminals. He planted in your head all kinds of fantasies. Let that go. Quit being his children and become women of this kingdom. There are things to do out there, I promise you this. Their mother pulls them into a fierce hug and kisses both their cheeks. When they are close, she whispers, He loved you too more than his words, more than his own breath. That will never die.
I miss him, Olga says, starting to cry again.
Yes, Mama says in a throaty voice. Forever. That's how long we'll have an empty place at the table. She draws back at last. But we will not speak of him again. Not ever. Not even to each other.
But you cannot just stop your feelings, Vera says.
Perhaps, her mother says. But you can refuse to express them, and that is what we will do. She puts her hand into the big pocket of her wool coat and pulls out a cloisonné butterfly. Vera has never seen anything so beautiful. This is not the kind of piece their family can own. It is something from the kings or the wizards, at least. Peter's father made this, her mother says, revealing a family history they knew nothing about. It was to be for the little princess. But the king thought it shoddy work, so your grandfather was fired and learned to make bricks of clay instead of pieces of art. He gave it to your father on our wedding day. And now it is what we have to remember someone in our family who is lost to us. Sometimes, if I close my eyes when I hold it, I can hear our Petya's laugh. It's just a butterfly, Vera says, thinking it is not so lovely as she'd thought. Certainly, it is not a substitute for her papa's laughter. It is all we have, her mother says gently. Vera wraps herself in grief as only a teenage girl can. But as the winter wanes and spring blooms across the kingdom, she begins to feel burdened by her melancholy.
It is not fair that I cannot go to university, she whines to her mother one warm summer day, many months after their makeshift funeral at the park.
They are kneeling in the black earth, weeding their small garden. Both have already worked a full day in the city. This is their summertime routine. A day's labor in the kingdom, and then a 2-hour cart ride beyond the walled city to the countryside, where they rent a small patch of ground.
You are too old to be whining about fairness, and obviously you know better, her mother says.
I want to study the great writers and artists.
Her mother sits back on her heels and looks at Vera. In the syrupy golden light that falls at 10 o'clock at night, she looks almost pretty again. Only her brown eyes remain stubbornly old.
You live in the Snow Kingdom, she says.
I think I know this.
Do you? You work in the greatest library in the world. There are 3 million books at your fingertips each day. The Royal Museum is on your way home, and your sister works there. Any time you wish, you can see the master's paintings. Galina Ulanova is dancing this season, and do not forget the opera.
She makes a tisking sound.
Do not tell me that a young woman of this kingdom needs to go to university to learn. If you believe such a thing, you are not,
her voice lowers, his daughter. It is the first time her mother has mentioned father, and it has the intended effect.
Vera slides sideways off her heels and sits in the warm dirt, looking down at the fragile green rosette of a baby cabbage beside her.
I am Peter Andreevich's daughter, she thinks. And in that reclamation, she remembers the books her father had read to her at night, and the dreams he'd encouraged her to dream.
For the remainder of that week, Vera contemplates the discussion in the garden. At work, she wanders around the library, walking amid the stacks with the ghost of her father beside her. She knows that all she needs is someone to help her understand the words she reads. It is as if she is a seedling, with a tender green strand pushing up through earth that resists her movement. The sun is up there, though, if only one keeps growing upward. And then one day she is at the counter organizing parchment rolls when a familiar face appears. It is an aged man walking with a cane across the marble floor, his tattered brown cleric's robes trailing along behind him. At the table near the wall, he sits down and opens a book. Vera approaches him slowly, knowing that her mother would not approve of her plan, but a plan it suddenly is.
Excuse me, she says softly to the man, who looks up at her through rheumy eyes.
Veronica? He says after a long moment.
Yes, she says. This man used to come by the house in older, better days.
She does not think to mention her father, but he is here between them as surely as the dust.
I am sorry to bother you, but I seek a tutor. I haven't much money.
The cleric removes his glasses. It takes him a while to speak, and when he does, his voice is barely more than a whisper.
I cannot help you myself. It is the times in which we live. I should stop writing. He sighs. As if I could. But I know some students, perhaps, that are not so afraid as an old man. I will ask.
Thank you.
Be careful, young Veronica, he says, putting on his glasses. And tell no one of this conversation.
This secret is safe with me.
The cleric doesn't smile.
No secret is safe.
14. It was almost midnight when Meredith finally got home. Exhausted by the length of the day, and yet captivated by tonight's story, she fed the dogs, played with them for a while, then changed into a comfortable pair of sweats. She was in the kitchen making herself a cup of tea when a car drove up. Jeff. Who else would it be at 12:30? She stood there, her hands gripping the sink's porcelain rim, her heartbeat going crazy as the front door opened. Nina walked into the kitchen, looking vaguely pissed off. Meredith felt a rush of disappointment. It's past midnight. What are you doing here? Nina walked over to the counter, grabbed a bottle of wine, found two coffee mugs in the sink, rinsed them out, and poured two glasses full.
Well, I'd like to talk about the story, which is becoming pretty damn detailed for a fairy tale, but since you're afraid of it, I'll say what I came for. We need to talk. Tomorrow is now. Tomorrow you'll be armored up again, and I'll be intimidated by your competence. Come on.
Then she took Meredith by the arm and led her into the living room, where she got a fire going by pressing a button. Whoosh went the gas flames, and on came the heat and light. Here, she said, handing Meredith a cup of wine.
Don't you think it's a little late for wine?
I'm not even going to answer that. You're lucky it's not tequila the way I'm feeling.
Nina, always the drama.
Meredith sat on one end of the sofa, her back tilted against the armrest. Nina sat on the opposite end. In the middle, their toes brushed against each other.
What do you want, Nina? Meredith asked.
My sister.
I don't know what you mean.
You were the one who took me trick-or-treating when Dad was working, remember? You always made my costume. And remember, when I tried out for cheerleader, you helped me with my routine for weeks, and when I made it, you were happy for me, even though you hadn't made the squad when you tried out? And when Sean Bowers asked me to the prom, you were the one who told me not to trust him. We might not have had much in common, but we were sisters.
Meredith had forgotten all of that. Or at least, she hadn't thought of it in years.
That was a long time ago. I went away and left you. I get it. And Mom is not an easy person to be left with, and we don't know each other very well, but I'm here now, Mare.
I see you.
Do you? Because frankly, you've been a bitch the last few days. Or maybe not a bitch, just kind of mopey. And one woman who won't talk to me at dinner is pretty much my quota.
Nina leaned forward.
I'm here. And I miss you, Mare. It's like you don't want to look at me or talk to me at all. I think Jeff left me.
Nina sat back abruptly.
What?
Meredith couldn't say it again. She shook her head, felt the sting of tears.
He's living at the motel by his office. That prick, Nina said.
Meredith actually laughed.
Thanks for not